You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
From the American South to the newsstands of Switzerland, another diverse, multifaceted issue of The Stack is ready for distribution. Cycling journals then and now, culture in the Carolinas, and making do in Midtown Manhattan. We searched the presses and met the editors the world over to bring you the very best in magazine printing this week. On today's edition of The Stack, we'll meet a man who likes to cycle and loves to write about cycling even more. We'll be getting the top picks from our innovative friends at a London-based independent magazine distributor, plus an American double bill by way of two reports, one a magazine from Charleston expressing the very best in Southern refinement.
From day one, there was always the goal to get some of the South's finest writers in the pages and let them tell their stories, and not overly direct them. And they've appreciated that, and the readers have certainly appreciated it.
From there, we'll be crossing the Mason-Dixon line up to New York, where an editor is looking creatively at how to make money.
I've always had that entrepreneurial drive and interest in just learning and doing research and making for its own sake. And I think you kind of need that to put up with a print industry at this point.
Plus, we'll be finding out what's on the newsstand and who exactly is buying it in Switzerland. All that and much more besides on this 61st edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. A little later on the programme, we'll be hearing from two expert magazine men. Guy Andrews, editor of what is undoubtedly the UK's most distinguished cycling title, Rouleur. And we'll also be hearing from Steve Watson, who runs Stack. Name sounds somewhat familiar. An independent magazine distribution service. But before all of that, let's cross over to the Alps. You may be wondering where your regular Stack host, our editor-in-chief, of course, Tyler Brulé, is. Well, I have an answer for you. He's on the end of a phone. He's with me right now. Tyler, welcome to The Stack. It seems odd introducing you on your own programme.
Indeed, but I'm not just on any phone. I actually have my very own ISDN mini studio set up here in the Alps. Everybody needs one.
It's pretty special. I'm looking at getting one for my flat here in Camden. Possibly not yet, but who knows when. Let's talk, Tyler, a little bit, though, about the media rather than the mountain landscape where you are, because pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the sort of the Swiss newsstand, you're obviously travelling, well, and been travelling extensively as usual recently, but it still strikes you, doesn't it, exactly what a different proposition it is when you get there.
Yeah, and it's hard to sort of pin down what are the forces. I think if you look at magazine, but also particularly newspaper consumption numbers, both Switzerland and also across the border in Austria, they rank as the two nations with the highest newspaper readership in the world. And you still get the sense of that. If you walk into the village, and there are two very good newsstands in the center of St. Moritz, as much as also a really good offer at the grocery stores as well, there's just a breadth of newspapers from all over Switzerland. So, you know, even though you're in a part of the country, you know, you're trapped in this valley, it's very logistically difficult to get a lot of things here, you can find newspapers from, I would probably say, you know, 50, 60 different national newspapers in Switzerland, plus then a breadth of titles from all over the world, including Japanese newspapers, Indian newspapers, which is really quite remarkable. But you know, I'm not sure if it's just given, you know, the international audience that happens to be in a place like St. Moritz, but also just the national appetite for print media still.
Absolutely. And I wonder, in terms of logistics, Tyler, you know, some people might say, well, hang on, isn't it a bit difficult making sure we get all the content we need out to these sort of mountain locations? But I gather they're also exploring ways of even sort of radicalizing the very means with which your print arrives with you when you go to the newsstand.
Well, that's one of the remarkable things, because when, of course, the various passes into this particular valley do get snowed in, and that happens, of course, quite frequently. In fact, even last week, Tom, they already had a half meter of snow, but it's proper autumn still. That all melted. But when that happens, though, you're not going to get your copy of the FT or the Wall Street Journal. You may get one or two newspapers that might be printed at this altitude. But what kiosk, and this is part of the national chain, it's owned by Valora, it would be the equivalent of what W.H. Smith would be in the UK, maybe what Newslink is like in Australia. you can go into not every single outlet, but you know, any of their certainly their flagship locations in any village in Switzerland, and they will print you one of 1,000 different newspapers. And it's not just a sort of a self-serve situation. You know, you go up to the cash desk, someone is there who will help you, and you say, I want to have Svenska Dagbladet today, or I want Børsen from Denmark, or I want the Globe and Mail from Canada. And you know, 5 minutes later, that newspaper is printed. Of course, then, if you're, if you live up here full time, you're able to go there first thing in the morning, and then they've got a really nice printed edition. It's not just on regular quality, you know, photocopier stock. They actually try to put it on a bit of a toothier type of print as well.
Amazing sort of innovation, Tyler. But I always think, well, hang on, that's going to be very expensive. And it's a different story, isn't it? Often in the US, here in the UK, of course, people are talking about making efficiencies, reining back exactly that kind of service provision. Why do you think there's so much confidence there that not only is it a service that's worth the money, but that, you know, the consumers will continue to be engaged by it?
Well, I think we only have to look at what's happening with in a number of international papers. We're seeing, you know, a paper which I contribute to, you know, the Financial Times, for example. You know, they're cutting back on print plants around the world right now, and it's amazing to see, you know, how many people are sort of up in arms about this slightly, and they think, look, it's great that you can push me to the iPad or to the digital edition. I still want a newspaper. And did you ever ask me, you know, how much I'm willing to pay for it? And I think, you know, of course, yes, if you want to have, you know, the National Post, you want to have the Sydney Morning Herald, of course it's not going to be at the Sydney or Toronto newsstand prices. You do need to pay a premium. But there's clearly, you know, a consumer, and I think that's one thing that people forget about as well, is that, you know, if we look at, you know, where the money is going to be over the next few years, you know, in major developed economies, we're talking about a graying society. Now, that doesn't mean that a graying society doesn't want to go digital. But, you know, people get a little older, Tom, and they get rather set in their ways. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. And it's actually worth, you know, still, you know, appealing to these types, you know, this type of audience as well, because they've got the purchase power, whether it's in, you know, dollars, pounds, or Swiss francs.
It's an incredible story, Tyler, no doubt. And I don't know what you're talking about old people being intransigent. I've never seen such a thing.
Not in our editorial floor ever.
Absolutely not. What's next in store, Tyler? I know will you be back in the stack chair next week? What will our listeners have then? And where will you be? What tales will you have to regale them with?
Well, I'll have all kinds of tales because I have been on the road for a while. I was with our editor, Andrew Tuck. In fact, there's one magazine called Beef, and we've talked about it, you know, once in a while. I saw this. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about it next week as well. But it's a really interesting magazine. It's a food magazine for men, Tom. Beef, für Männer mit Geschmack. For men with taste. And there's a wonderful story in here, though, and it's about a big grill festival which happened in Kansas City, Missouri. And the headline is, Yes, We Kansas. And I thought that sort of sounds like a headline that Andrew Tuck would write.
He'd be justified, be proud of it as well.
He would.
That all sounds very exciting. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you back here in at Midori House in the coming weeks, Tyler. I just wondered finally, if you were sort of going to bring one fresh lesson that you've learned in your most recent travels about, you know, the state of the print nation all around the world. Is there anything you take away? I guess you're talking about robustness where you are right now. Is that echoed all around the world? Are you still very upbeat about everything?
I'm very upbeat. In fact, speaking of Andrew Tuck, we did a bit of a co-anchored signing session for our book in New York. Week before last, we were at McNally Jackson. And one of the amazing things was we arrived in this space, which was the basement space of the bookstore, Tom, and we thought, okay, well, there's just a little signing table, and Andrew and I would be signing our books like we've done in, you know, 15 or 16 other cities already. But it was actually almost like a sort of a town hall or a church hall meeting. It was set up with chairs. There was a microphone. And I thought, well, we weren't really sort of, you know, in for this. But then, you know, 45 minutes later, you know, it is very difficult to get, you know, to pry a microphone away from us. And one of the remarkable things was, you know, here you had a very engaged audience, you know, in a market like New York, of course, a very dynamic media market. But everyone wanted to hear a good news story about print. It was really interesting. And of course, you know, maybe, yes, we are preaching to the converted. It is a monocle audience. But, you know, but I think there are also people who are asking us challenging questions about, you know, how we're doing it, et cetera. And I think that there is a sense on the part of consumers, even in the world's biggest economy, also economy of woe like the US when it comes to print media, that people don't want to just be railroaded into one way of consuming media. And that's a good message.
Absolutely. And Well, you have to give the public what they want, Tyler. That's why they set you in a little town hall
meeting.
Like wonderful stuff. That's Tyler Brulé from St Moritz talking to us. Tyler will be back in the stack chair next week. On this week's edition, though, we're going to get stuck into our stacks of magazines with Guy and Steve right after this. Hello, and if you've just tuned in, I'm Tom Edwards. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're hearing from our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, with the latest on the Swiss newsstands a moment or two ago. But we're now definitely back in London, where I'm delighted to say I'm joined by two special guests. Over the past 15 years, Guy Andrews has written several books on the subject of bicycle maintenance, the building of custom bikes, and describes himself as a competitive road biker. Guy, welcome to Stack. Thanks very much for joining us. I just wanted to ask you, first of all, do you think we're in a bit of a golden age of not just for cycling, particularly here in the UK, but for cycling and cycling publishing? Are we in an era that we should be enjoying? Do you think it's never been so good?
We're in a purple patch. Yes, definitely. We were just talking about this before we came in. The figures are good for cycling magazines right now, which can't be said for a lot of other consumer titles. But anyway, yeah, it's good. It's very good, yeah.
What do you think's behind that? Is it the classic thing where, you know, there seems to be a perfect storm? We had, certainly in this country, you know, the Olympics. We've had so much success on the roads. Does that the driver? Or do you think that the magazine sector specifically for bikes and bike enthusiasts, I mean, it has a momentum of its own, doesn't it now?
Yeah, I'd say that it goes back quite a long time, actually, because road cycling's been in boom for longer than, say, the London Olympics. Previous to that, I'd actually mentioned Lance Armstrong. Actually, somebody asked me about him the other day. He's persona non grata in cycling in the sports world, but he kind of kick-started the interest, certainly in the English-speaking world, because before then, obviously, cycling's culturally, sports cycling has been very much a continental European thing. English-speaking riders have only, I'd suggest, recently come to the fore. So, you know, it's a mixture of that, but then also the success of Great Britain and the Olympic team in this country has made a massive difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. Someone like Armstrong, obviously formerly a sort of a divisive figure, now not so divisive. Pretty much everyone sings from the same hymn sheet. But do you think it's still good as a sort of, a journalist and a publisher of magazines? You know, we're all about telling stories at the end of the day. Do you think it's still good to actually have characters like him? For all of the villainy and the misdeeds, it's still a good thing, isn't it? Just because we love a story like that.
I have a sort of slightly controversial stance on Lance Armstrong. I actually think, well, we would certainly never have been able to do our magazine without him. There's no doubt. You know, I mean, I think he actually did an enormous amount for cycling as a character and a personality. But obviously since then, the story has gone downhill. Rapidly.
Fairly fast.
And everybody now sort of is scratching their head as wondering to what I'd say about him next. My jury's still out, to be honest. I've met him a couple of times. He's a quite strange individual. But you know what? He's done an awful lot for cycling.
Intriguing stuff. We'll be hearing
an
more.
An awful lot of bad as well.
Well, exactly. We'll be hearing more of the good and the bad, I imagine, with Guy later. Also here in the studio with me is Steve Watson, a keen champion of the UK and global magazine scene, founder of the innovative magazine distributor Stack. We approve of the name, of course, which Steve started.
I was there first.
No, come on, let's keep it civil. Steve started 3 years ago in an attempt to help independent publishers find a wider readership. He's written and edited magazines for the last 10 years. Steve, welcome back to our Stack. How's it all going? Still a sector in rude health? You never suddenly stop and think, oh my God, I made a terrible mistake. Still feeling upbeat? Is the scene looking good?
Certainly lots of new magazines coming out. Whether that means the sector is in rude health or not, I think is a different matter. I mean, anybody involved in magazines, independent or otherwise, knows that it's bloody hard to make a proper living out of them. So, Guy and I were just talking about this before we came on, but there are some mags that are doing a really good job. There are some that are coming up and show a lot of promise. And, the great thing about Stack is that we just keep turn it over all the time. So, you know, that when a magazine does sadly pass away, it can be replaced by another one that's coming up.
And is that probably the thing that still keeps you most excited about the project, is that kind of turnover, that constant sense of, you know, even in those dark days when we lose a brother magazine, there is something around the corner. There's still people who have an entrepreneurial flair, who want to make something happen. That's going to be pretty good to be around that kind of dynamism.
Yeah, it's good. To be honest, the main thing is just the quality of the mags themselves. You know, the few years ago when I was doing Stack much more as a kind of evenings and weekends thing, and yeah, I would get home and kind of wonder why I was doing it sometimes, and then I'd open an envelope and someone had sent me this incredible new magazine, and you just think, well, yeah, that's why I'm doing it, because this is really great and more people need to see this.
And does that, I imagine that once you become more established, those moments, the sort of revelations, are probably more infrequent, because, you know, people send you probably more stuff all the time, you're more tuned in and plugged into all the things that are happening. But do you still have those same kind of, like, from nowhere revelations?
Oh, totally,
where the
yeah.
envelope opens?
Yeah, stuff. I mean, and, you know, so sometimes, like, this literally this morning, I just put an Instagram video up of Fat, which is a mag that I think you featured on here a couple of weeks ago. And I'd heard about it, I'd spoken to the creators, I knew it was coming. But you open the cardboard package and it's just so much better than I thought it was going to be. And I thought it was going to be good. But it's just, yeah, it's a treat. It's a real treat.
What a nice way around that is, to have high expectations and then have them surpassed. That's a good. Let's hope we can continue in that vein. Let's have a bit of a look then at the stacks that you have with you today. Guy, why don't we start with you? Where should we launch our journey today?
Well, do you want to start
today?
In the real world now, or in times gone by? Maybe I'll start with this magazine called Modern Farmer, which is
a handsome goat featured.
A handsome goat on the front cover. I'm quite fond of goats myself. So I just think this is everything that magazines should be. I mean, I don't know anything about farming, but I found myself reading pretty much everything that's in it. And I think I just think it's brilliant. I don't know much about it. All I know is it's in its second issue. It's fantastic. And it's a kind of magazine, they've got Bill Clinton as a columnist. So, you know, it's
wheeling out the big guns.
Tell
us a little bit about sort of the look and the substance of it then, because as I said, it's got this very arresting goat picture.
Well, actually, I
may ask you more about your personal goat connections in a minute.
Well, actually, it does feel a little bit Monocle. You know, it's you know, there's some nice infographics, there's some nice illustrations. The photography's consistent. You know, it's all good. The advertising, we were talking about this just now, the advertising actually is as good as the editorial. And you sort of think, well, farming advertising, really? But anyway, it's just really nicely put together, I think. And then there's some products at the back that I found quite interesting. So, yeah, it's all good. There's actually even celebrities and what vegetable they would be, which is quite...
Now, that sounds like magazine gold to me.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess if you hear farming magazine, there'd be some preconceived notions.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the risks would be to sort of almost go too far the other way and say, well, actually, we're going to explode all of those preconceptions. It's going to be completely explosive and ridiculous and over the top. But this is a pretty fine line, and they've sort of judged it almost perfectly.
I think there's sort of a trend as well for... we're going to talk about one of Steve's mags he's brought in, which is about alcohol, not just specifically about alcohol. But I think there's a trend, but there's a sort of a thing about... Well, it says on here, farm, food, life. It's sort of like, you know... all that sort of stuff that happens in the home, how it happens. And I think, I don't know, I applaud it. I think it's brilliant, because I think magazines should do that. They should actually tell people stuff about the stuff that they use in daily life. And there's a big thing in here about waste, which is terrifying. Mm. There's also a really interesting fact about roadkill in America. I didn't know deer were killed. Is it deer? Yeah, I think it's deer that were killed every year in America. It's 1.23 million.
What?
I thought maybe a few hundred thousand, but yeah, that's quite a lot.
But
anyway, I think that's the thing. I came away from reading this thinking that's good.
That's pretty amazing.
I
just
remember
wonder,
that fact.
Yeah, no doubt. Especially with your goat background, it's particularly interesting. Steve, I wonder, would that be enough to sort of help you unleash your inner farmer? You see a magazine like that. Does it do enough, do you think, to break down perhaps those sort of preconceptions that I mentioned before?
I'm now flicking through for the first time. Let me try and have an opinion on this.
Do you like the goat on the cover? That's the main question.
The goat looks lovely. It's got weird devil eyes, as all goats do. This looks like the sort of mag. It's clearly made by people who know what they're doing. So you get some mags that come out, and it's the first time that people have ventured into like making mags before. You can tell right from the start, this is clearly done by people who know what they're doing. Nice little spread here. The kids are all right with some young goats.
Oh, that's award-winning puns right there. I like it. I love
that
one.
It looks good. Looks good. It reminds me a lot of Good magazine from a few years ago, with the way that they kind of the way that they sort of like try to show the whole story with illustration and infographic and like sort of long written pieces as well.
Great stuff. Telling the whole story, that's what we're all about here on the stack. Steve, I'm actually going to make you wait. We're going to delve into your stack in just a moment. Because up next, we're going to be heading to Charleston. We're going to be hearing about Garden and Gun magazine. Stay tuned.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living begins hitting shelves around the world. Our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're heading in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Up a set of creaky stairs and above a former pharmacy on Charleston's King Street, one finds the headquarters of Garden and Gun, the provocatively titled magazine that's an ode to the American South. A national magazine with a deeply regional focus, Garden and Gun offers a look at the distinct cultural factors that define contemporary living in that neck of the woods. A commitment to long-form storytelling and smart prose have helped the magazine develop a strong readership well beyond its South Carolina home. Monocle's Barrett Austin recently caught up with Garden and Gun editor-in-chief David DiBenedetto for a chat about the value of a good story and why it's no simple order to write about Southern barbecue.
I'll tell you to see the porch. I'm David DiBenedetto. I'm the editor-in-chief of Garden and Gun magazine. We're not a magazine about gardens, and we're not a magazine about guns. We are a Southern lifestyle magazine, and the magazine wasn't named after, but it was sort of inspired by a club that had opened here in Charleston in the 70s called the Garden and Gun Club. And it was the place that everyone wanted to be after hours. It was just a good, grand time. But when when our current CEO, thought about that name and what it could mean, the garden certainly kind of skewed towards the women, and the guns, as a sporting culture, skewed towards the men.
If you could just give sort of an introduction, what does this magazine cover?
This magazine covers everything I love about the South, and thankfully that's what a lot of people love about the South. The food, the art, the culture, the landscape, and certainly the sporting culture. There are a number of things that grow from this appreciation of from the land, and Garden and Gun is derived from that in many ways.
Walk me through a traditional issue of this magazine. What do you find if you pick up Garden and Gun? What are some of the stories that you tend to cover?
You hit on something when you said stories, because every page of the magazine, whether it's the front of the book newsy section, or it's the middle of the book style section, or if it's the feature well or the travel section, everything has a story. When we talk about, what's going to make it into an issue, there are two components. One, what's the photography going to look like? Because we want it to be beautiful. We want it to represent the South. And then what's the story? This may be a new lodge or this may be a new artist, but what's the backstory? What can we tell? We want to grab people with the photography and we want to surprise them with the writing on every page.
Covering the South both as a geographic region and also sort of as a theme, do you ever find it challenging being limited to that? Or do you find that the South in itself as a place and as a theme is sort of, something that's untapped, something that you can always find something good and interesting to put into the magazine?
It amazes me every issue how many stories there are to tell. How many great, interesting people who are in the South doing interesting, smart things, and who haven't had their stories told. So it hasn't been difficult. It hasn't felt limiting. Certainly, we go outside of the South. We've got, you know, a big chunk of our readership's in California. Another chunk is in New York. And we cover the southernness and places beyond the Mason-Dixon line. But as finding stories go in the South, it has not been a challenge and not been limiting. The challenge really is deciding what makes the cut.
Talk a little bit about the history of writing and journalism in the South, both, you know, sort of more literary writing, but also journalism.
You know, the tradition is storied from Faulkner to, you know, some of the great newspapers in Mississippi, you know, all over. There is an appreciation of good writing, and a lot of that good writing springs from the fertility of the land and the fertility of the stories, the abundance of the stories. And certainly we try to reflect that in the magazine. From day one, there was always the goal to get some of the South's finest writers in the pages and let them tell their stories and not overly direct them. And they've appreciated that, and the readers have certainly appreciated it. You know, the reader wants to be in the hands of a good storyteller, and that's what the South's all about.
Tell me about some of the stories that are coming up in Garden and Gun over the next couple of months. What are the big things that are getting you excited?
You know, December, January is always our sporting issue. And I've got an unbelievable essay by Rick Bragg on hunting raccoons with coon hounds as a kid in West Virginia. And here's an unbelievably talented writer, you know, one of the most eloquent, smart guys that I know. And then to hear of him growing up, and it's a very rough and tumble community, and, you know, they're wearing socks on their hands for gloves. But it's about what he learned on those nights in the, you know, in the cold mountains chasing a bunch of hound dogs. When Rick Bragg writes anything, I just love it.
Garden and Gun launched back in 2007, which we can all attest was not the easiest time to be launching a magazine. There are a lot of magazines that have shuttered since then, and a number of others that have gotten thinner and thinner, and in many cases less interesting and less purposeful. But you've been in this industry for a number of years. What are the big changes that you've seen take place as far as print culture goes over the past, say, 5 to 7 years?
Well, you know, everybody got shorter. Everything got shorter. All the stories became quicker, quicker hits. We were all competing with the web. We knew we were, you know, vying for people's attention, and we knew it was hard to get. So we made everything shorter. We made everything quicker. But that's not what Garden and Gun does. It sort of takes the opposite form of that and just went longer, went thicker, went richer, went denser, richer in terms of storytelling. So it's worked for us.
If you look at the evolution of print publications, what are some of the differences, the changes, the themes, or trends perhaps that you're noticing in magazines today as opposed to ones that we might have read 5 or 10 years ago?
It's amazing how you can enhance a story with your digital assets. I mean, it's so unbelievable that you can read a great profile of someone and on the digital edition, then hit a button and watch a video and hear their voice and see them making a certain dish or whatever it may be, or listen to the track from an artist. It allows you to go behind the scenes in a way that you couldn't go before, and it's just so multidimensional. To me, it's just great. And for a magazine like Garden and Gun, we just keep getting deeper, and it's just, you know, discovering more layers and layers that the readers seem to appreciate, which certainly you have to be thinking on different levels than you used to, but it's so much more rewarding.
We've kind of touched on this, but tell me about Garden and Gun's readership, because, you know, the magazine is based in Charleston, which is in the Deep South. Many of the topics that you're covering are in this sort of region, but I gather you have readers far beyond the Deep South.
Absolutely. You know, I think the latest figure is 43% of the readership outside of the South, California being the largest state, New York being the second, and it moves on from there. And that's a mix. Those aren't just ex-Southerners who have moved on to do other things. Those are Californians who, you know, have the same appreciation of the land and good writing and photography that we do and that the readers do. So it's certainly a national magazine about a very interesting region.
That was David DiBenedetto in conversation with R. Barrett Austin, talking about Garden and Gun in Charleston. You're with The Stack on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
When is a shop more than just a shop? Monocle visits three bricks-and-mortar businesses offering unique products and impeccable service in Toronto, Paris, and in Madrid.
The fascinating thing about spices is spices actually are a bit of the history of the opening up of the world, because different spices will tell you a little bit about where people went and what they brought back, and it's fascinating when you actually follow any spice.
Trader's Secrets Revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
So I am still here with Guy Andrews and Steve Watson on The Stack. Steve, the floor is yours. Where should we begin? It's an appealing looking stack. Where should we open our account?
Guy mentioned the Booze magazine just now, so let's get into that. This is Hot Rum Cow, which is a magazine that I think started last year. It is made by a content marketing agency called White Light Media, based up in Edinburgh. And they do a lot of work with big banks and stuff up there, a lot of quite serious kind of B2B customer publishing. And they basically wanted something for their staff to get their teeth into and enjoy, and something to sort of flex their muscles and show what else they could do. So they had a long think and decided to come up with a mag about booze, because the thing that they all liked was booze.
It speaks to every audience.
Yeah, exactly. So. And it's been really interesting seeing it develop. The first issues that came out, I think kind of you could really see that history of customer publishing in there. So they were very well put together, but they looked like quite a serious formal mag. And this issue has just come out. It's the Sherry issue, and just in time for Christmas. So the cover line is Sherry for a wildlife, not just for Christmas. Completely illustrated cover. This one, I think, is really starting to hit its stride. And I think that it looks like they're having a lot of fun with it. And I always think that when you open a magazine and you get the sense that the editorial team's having fun, it kind of makes it half the battle.
And as you said, it's an illustrated cover. It has a kind of an old-fashioned quality in some ways, but it's sort of an agreeable, endearing sort of colloquial quality to it. And there's quite a lot of illustrations, aren't there, inside as well. It's not just a proving ground for everything you can do, but it's a chance, I guess, to, as you said, you know, flex muscles where perhaps some of these other B2B publications can be a little austere, almost by definition. There's not that much scope, perhaps, to be really creative.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you know, this is something that a lot more content marketing companies are doing these days. You know, it may not be they're launching their own mag, but they're doing stuff, like other stuff that they can like claim for their own. Mm-hmm. And then that gives them a chance to sort of show off to potential clients and say, look, we're not just about this, we can do this stuff too.
Guy, let's delve back into your stack of magazines. Can you see the goat and raise him in terms of cover styles?
Well, I'm actually going to go back to an old magazine. I'm quite interested about what's missing in magazines these days that used to be in magazines that was really, really good. And I happened to pick up this copy of Cyclisme magazine, French magazine, which is published by L'Équipe, still is actually in existence, but I don't think it's called that anymore. But anyway, the point is that inside, and this is their tour preview guide, usually a magazine I cannot stand, any tour preview guide, Tour de France, that is, I won't go near it. But this has got a map, a beautiful map of the tour.
Oh, here we are. This is like a cartographical special. Yeah.
Which will definitely now be framed now I've found it, because it's beautiful. But then also, which really got me quite excited, was, excuse me for admitting it, but in the back of the mag is the Tour de France stage by stage. And every day there is a little bit for you to fill in for the classmen, and whoever owned this magazine actually filled in the record, beautiful handwriting, I hasten to add. But there is a bit at the back where they obviously lost interest. I'd like to think that they went on holiday to go and watch the Tour de France, forgot the mag, left it at home, and then obviously, you know, it got forgotten. But I saw this and I thought, this is the sort of thing that used to be, you know, this used to be bread and butter for magazines, and now, you know, that sort of thing, that sort of whole idea of you being involved with the magazine has kind of drifted and disappeared, which I think is a bit of a shame. I'm not saying we're going to do this, but you know, I just really like that.
No, why
just,
not?
I just love the fact that this man's handwriting's on it.
It's, absolutely. And you know, what?
Or woman.
What era are we in here? So
this is the 70s. I mean, it's not
winning,
that.
Who's winning all those stages? What's the? What's
well,
the
that would have been Merckx.
Name?
That would have been Merckx. Eddie Merckx. Oh, and actually, I don't know if he did. No, I don't know if he did. Van Imp, Lucien Van Imp.
What's the overall winner?
Well, we didn't get that far.
Oh, that was the point. I mean, well, maybe they were a Merckx fan.
And I think it
like
was. I think Merckx did win that.
Oh, maybe,
that year.
Maybe they just found it was too much of a foregone conclusion. Yeah, yeah. They just lost interest along the way.
Yeah, but that, and I did actually bring in, but I think I've saved this for once Steve's gone on one of his, because there's some stuff in here that it's an old magazine, but it does. It does reflect on what Steve's going to talk about, I hope, right now.
No. which one was that?
You go for it.
Well, exactly. Look, go on, Steve. Now, you've been teed up by Guy there, so which is...
Okay. I'm going to try and guess at the
That's
one that
the
Guy's
one.
Talking about. Oh, okay, I got it right. Okay. So this is Saucy. It's a magazine made by a journalist called Kristen Taylor. I think it's quarterly. And I've brought this along because I normally don't really like mags that don't have a lot of words in them. I sort of feel a little bit shortchanged when it's all pretty pictures. This one doesn't have many words in it, but the words that are there are very, very carefully chosen. It's almost sort of a magazine as poem. And so it's basically all about the time she spent in Miami 5 years ago. And she begins with a Baudrillard quote from Simulacra and Simulation, which is all about sort of, you know, is this representation real? How much of this can I trust? And she, in her editor's note, talks about being an unreliable narrator. And then you're into this magazine, which is lots of big, beautiful images and kind of little dramatic lines of poetry that sort of suggest that the sort of life that she led in Miami. But then you're reading it and you're thinking, this is too dramatic. Sure, she didn't really live this. There's some pictures of these banyan trees, and she says, when I needed solace, I went into the supple limbs of the banyan trees that curved together over walls and around barriers. And you're thinking, that would, did you? No. No, I don't think you did. But I just find it absolutely fascinating. And as I said, there's not a lot to read in it, but I've been back over this several times, and I think, as with poetry, you kind of find something new in it each time you go back.
It's really interesting. And you talk a bit there about sort of blurring the lines between, yeah, what's a magazine? Is it a piece of poetry? We talk quite often on the stack about the magazine as a book. I mean, sometimes they're almost at the same kind of prices as a hardback book, but there's a value in that, and you do treat it as that, something to keep and treasure in your library. But that almost blurs the two. I mean, it looks almost like an art catalogue, doesn't it, to a certain extent? Mm. And it's incredible rich colours in the pictures. Mm. Do you think there's enough of that kind of boldness in terms of editorial approach, or I guess it's maybe the publisher's boldness perhaps as much as anything? Does that happen enough? Are people maybe a little too cautious? Or do you think there's still enough breadth in the marketplace to sustain titles that are as innovative as that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in this case it helps that she is writer, editor, photographer, publisher. She's doing the whole thing. And I think that, you know, in independence, you do tend to get more of that because you have someone with a singular vision, or, you know, a couple of people with a singular vision, and they're going to pursue that come hell or high water. I mean, that's why when you sort of like you get to kind of the bigger, more grown up end of the scale, you do actually have to start pleasing the advertisers and doing those other things. So I think that, well, you know, scratch the surface and you find there's actually quite a lot of this sort of stuff out there.
Fantastic stuff. That's Steve Watson talking about Saucy magazine and others. I'm with Guy Andrews from Ruleur and Steve Watson from Stack here on The Stack on Monocle 24. More from Guy and Steve a little later in the programme. Up next, though, we're going to be heading up to New York. It is to New York where we head next. Steve Daniels is the director of Makeshift, a magazine that seeks to uncover creative solutions from the economic fringe. It's a beautifully designed quarterly that includes photo essays and reports from all over the world, thanks to a growing network of contributors on the ground. Though already in its seventh issue, and with a rapidly increasing popularity, Makeshift is only one of Daniels' many occupations, which include a full-time job as a software designer. He invited Monocle's Pauline Eiferman to Makeshift's headquarters, his living room in Midtown Manhattan.
The magazine started as a collaboration between myself, at the time doing research on roadside makers and emerging markets, and Miles Estee, who is a photojournalist and journalist. based in Mexico City, formerly Liberia. We were both working on similar projects from different angles and decided to collaborate.
And you knew him from, he was a friend of yours?
So I was doing my research in Kenya at the time on informal metalworking, kind of roadside blacksmiths. I was writing a book about it called Making Do. He was writing a book about street vendors called Getting By. And he found out about my book and wrote me an email saying, hey, you stole my idea. He never finished his book. It's actually maybe potentially going to be a film that we're working on together. But I beat him to the punch, and then we decided to collaborate.
So tell me about how the first issue was made and how you worked together on it.
Yeah, so the two of us worked remotely. We had still never met. I'm in New York. He's in Mexico City. We both travel quite a lot. He covers stories all throughout Latin America. And we hacked together kind of a vision, pulled together our networks of writers, did a Kickstarter campaign. We raised $45,000. And when we finally released the magazine, we launched it at a conference called A Better World by Design. Miles and I met the day of the conference in Providence. Right after we met, the shipment of magazines arrived. So it's kind of this coalescing moment where we're finally holding the product in our hands and finally meeting after so much of this kind of virtual working on this thing that didn't exist yet.
And what was the first issue about? And can you tell me who wrote the stories and what was inside?
So the first issue came out of a blog that we had been contributing to called Reculture. And it's all about the cultures of reuse, recycling, repair at the grassroots. And we had contributors from all over the world that were contributing to that blog. So that's kind of a natural nod that we gave in the first issue. And photo essays about textile recyclers in India, people who make their own tools. That was, at the time, was a contributor network of 20. Now we're 200, let's say, in order of magnitude, covering 75 or so countries.
And how do you find these contributors?
You know, our networks keep growing, so Miles and I each bring our own networks. We now have a core team of about 7 all over the world. It's New York, Mexico City, Madrid, Tokyo, Buenos Aires, Athens. So that's kind of the core team. And we all kind of spread out from there. And it's a mix of people signing up for our contributors email list. And then, you know, we find a lot of our stories that we want to tell, not through pitches, but by actually digging for all sorts of different variants and lenses on a theme for the issue. So if we need to find out how email spammers operate in Nigeria, and we don't have someone in Nigeria, well, got to find someone on the ground there, and then they become part of our network. So we definitely at this point have a loyal base of recurring pitching contributors, and then we kind of put our feelers out, our octopus tentacles, right, out into the rest of those areas.
And to back up a little bit, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you ended up in Kenya in the first place?
I didn't set out to be a journalist or an editor by any means. It's an engineer, sociologist, kind of. Now I actually work full-time in my day job as a software designer, which wasn't my training. I've always had that entrepreneurial drive and interest in just learning and doing research and making for its own sake. And I think you kind of need that to put up with a print industry at this point. So all of those combined, just it was the right opportunity to do what started out as an interesting project that was mixing research with communication and rebranding a sector that no one was looking at into something I think much bigger today.
And why do you think the magazine was the outlet that you chose? I mean, it could have been a website or anything else.
When I decided I wanted to learn more about digging into the economic fringes and uncovering creative solutions and all the context there, I had a couple of choices. I decided I could take a year off from my job and have a very expensive trip where I was traveling to all different cities, or I could create a research platform where people who are already on the ground there could contribute, and that would bring also a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different talents, And that has been really effective for me because I've now picked up photojournalism myself and now can write. I get different cultural perspectives from our contributors that I wouldn't have gotten if I had just gone and tried to do it by myself. Print was, I think, a natural choice for this topic because a lot of what we write about is very kind of physical, tangible stories. We also were trying to legitimize an area of research that was seen as, I don't know, too fringe, for example. You know, when people look at the magazine and they see the craft and design and brand that went into it, it gives it a sort of legitimacy.
That was Makeshift's Steve Daniels talking to Monocle's Pauline Eiferman in Midtown Manhattan. It's all about the M's here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this, where the stack resumes, with Guy and Steve. Stay tuned.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. With me in the studio still, Guy Andrews and Steve Watson. Guy, let's return to you. Now, I know your next selection sort of talks back to Saucy Magazine that Steve was chatting about before. What have you got for us? And why did it strike you that there was a strand that linked the two?
Kind of doesn't. It doesn't. I think I bought in an old copy of Fortune magazine from November 1947. And it's huge,
but that is a large format.
It is,
right,
yeah, it is. It's lovely. But the interesting thing that I found in it is that you find yourself flicking through something that is very mainstream, and this is a long time ago, 1947. But the use of colour and the use of type is so contemporary, and that's the thing that we always kind of look back to go forward, you know, often with magazine design. But that kind of really struck me. It's not really a counterpoint to Saucy. I mean, it kind of is in a way, because what's amazing about these old magazines, and especially Fortune, is that Fortune's kind of a different thing now to what it was then. Mm-hmm. What it was then was actually, this sounds terrible, but a really, really good magazine, and now, not so good. And that's the thing that is interesting, what Steve was saying about independence, because independents grow and change and evolve into usually very, very good magazines. We've seen many, and we've talked about a few today. You know, Colours magazine, for example. You know, and they all sort of float free. And I just think that's quite interesting that Fortune at one point was a magazine that we would probably all pick up, but now we probably wouldn't. But you know, it's interesting how those things change. I can't see how Saucy would change to being anything remotely like Fortune, but I mean, I applaud it and I think it's great because I just love the fact that people are still enthusiastic about making magazines, because that's what's important. Obviously, yes, it has to ring bells with people, and obviously Steve loves it, so that's great, but it's not really my thing, but, you know, hey.
You've not read it.
I've not read it yet. No.
Read the poetry.
I do need to read it.
I must say, I mean, just looking across the table at this Fortune from, when was it, 47?
1947, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Incredible. Like the topography.
It's amazing.
American
it
bizarre feature that it sort of had fallen open on. But every page,
it's
avant-garde, but it's definitely, it doesn't have that old-fashioned quality in inverted commas, does it?
Yeah, it's interesting because the editorial really stands out from the advertising. I mean, it's just some of the page layouts are just amazing. Actually, our designer picked this up, Rob Johnson, and he loves it. So I've got him to thank for bringing this along. But it is really contemporary in how it treats colour, how it uses type. I mean, it is, you know, fantastic.
I'm intrigued, Steve, when you see these sort of old favourites, even going back, you know, a couple of generations almost. What do you make of them? Do you sort of still always see the? Is it a linear progression then, from magazines like that to where we are now, or do you think that these things change? You know, fashions come and go, but some of the things that have enduring quality will always be as compelling to sort of magazine buffs as they were probably the day that they hit the newsstands in the first place. Mm.
Well, I mean, one of the things I'm really interested in is that, so looking at that copy of Fortune, is the way that the actually physically making a magazine has changed. And so you can see that the layouts that they have there, you can actually see how the page has been physically assembled. Whereas now, you know, with InDesign, you can have like stuff looping in from here and crossing over there. And I think that's probably the biggest change to between something like that and what we see today. But I mean, certainly, you know, I can't imagine there are many magazine designers that don't spend a little bit of time looking back at stuff like that and, you know, kind of getting inspiration for what they're doing now.
Well, absolutely. And I think photographers as well. I mean, it is interesting. Taz Darling, one of our photographers, passed me this magazine. Well, I don't know if we've got time to talk about it,
really quickly. What have you got there?
It's basically a brand. I don't know anything about this. It's a brand documentary magazine. And they take each issue, they take a product, and it's all about that product in that one issue. And it's, I just think that whole kind of, it just turns the whole idea of a magazine on its head, really. Mm-hmm. It's a Korean magazine, and it kind of has a certain charm to it. A lot of the products that they feature are European products as well. So obviously there's a fascination for them there. But I just think it's I can't quite get my head around how it happens and how that has happened. From, you know, looking back at old stuff, you kind of think that they'd never even dream of doing that. And I think that's the beauty of magazines, and that kind of, you know, corresponds into what Steve was saying about Saucy Magazine. It's kind of, you know, think of an idea, come up with something and do it, and I think that's brilliant.
Great stuff. I just wonder then, as a sort of closing note on the stacks that we have here, what do you think about the general state of the market? I mean, Steve, you talk about you're still getting surprised every day, which is obviously a delight. Guy, we talk about sort of the Rude Health, particularly in sort of, you know, cycling magazines, but across the whole spectrum. Do you still think that there's enough reason to be optimistic as we look ahead? We're hearing from Tyler at the top of the show about the robust state of the newsstand in, you know, middle Europe. Is there enough all around the world? We have these areas, pockets of success, pockets of passion, but do you think we are still in a robust climate? Is it sustainable to keep all of the different publications, all the people who are coming with fresh ideas, trying to make them work? Is it still a good proving ground for them? Is it still going to give them the opportunity to make the great magazines as we go forwards?
Yes.
Love it. Nice and succinct. And presumably, Steve, do you go along with that?
No.
There we are.
I think that you know, I do a fair bit of kind of like teaching on magazines. I meet a lot of people who are just starting out, and one of the things that I'm really keen to say to them is this is a big risk. You're taking a really big risk doing this. Only do it if you love it and you can't stand the idea of the world without this in it, because that's what it's going to take. You know, potentially the reward's there, but it's really hard work.
That's a good lesson. A good lesson to all our eager listeners out there, maybe. Some people are starting off and wondering whether they have what it takes. Listen to the wise words of Steve Watson and Guy Andrews. My thanks to both of them for being here on The Stack today. That is the end of edition 61 here at Midori House. Guy Andrews and Steve Watson, my guests. My producer was David Pleasant. Also behind the glass was our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, do get in touch. info@monocle.com is the way to do that. And we'll be back at the very same time next week with another episode of The Stack. But this time, from me, Tom Edwards, that is all. Goodbye.